Der Design-Podcast der Burg.
So we are recording. Very welcome to the already 18th episode of the Hurra Hurra Podcast. And I'm very happy to have Prem Krishnamurti today as my guest. And he was also at the Hurra Hurra Festival last year. And it was more like a rumor or like a thing that went through the house. Oh, Prem Krishnamurti is coming. Prem Krishnamurti is coming. And I was like, hey, who is Prem? Because the students did all the programming and all the curating of the guests. And I was more busy in other things. So I'm very happy to have you here, Prem. And just to answer my question first, who is Prem Krishnamurti? Who are you and what are you doing?
Well, I'll take a line from Karl Martens, a dear friend, colleague, mentor. I remember asking him a couple of years ago, so Karl, what should I call you these days? And he said, I'm a human being. So I feel like, you know, sometimes I guess if I'm more descriptive, I'll say I'm a designer, a curator, a writer, and a teacher. But I also think that more and more these days, I think about myself as being also an organizer, a facilitator, a person who creates space for other people while also finding ways to create space for myself. And so I don't know. I mean, these days there are lots of ways to describe a person, but I think that the human being is still a really good one.
Yeah, obviously, like from my perspective, and you're here online, so we only see through a shared screen all the things visible to me seems pretty human, but due to technological invention, this is not really a safe fact in the end. But coming to your talk at the Hurra Hurra Festival, so I had a check in the program, and you said it's a rough rehearsal, a hypothetical talk. Can you remember what you did there?
Yes, I mean, I think it was a long time ago. It was a year ago, which nowadays with Corona, it feels like it's actually 10 years ago since 2020 was a decade. But I think that I rehearsed, I tried to do something that had two different modes. I tried to rehearse a talk that I was going to be giving in just a couple of days in a big conference with maybe 600 people. And it was a whole new line of thinking for me, or at least a line of thinking I'd never made public before. But then I also tried to invert the situation where we would workshop it. So I gave a kind of frontal lecture, very kind of TED Talk keynote-y style for 30 minutes, but then I inverted it and I had everybody pair up with somebody who was on the opposite side of the room, and I totally changed the room. We all kind of put our chairs away and sat on the floor, and then had people come up with a comment, a critique, or a question for me. And then we had a kind of workshop. And I think I heard from people afterwards that I think it was very unexpected in that the first part of it felt very, very hierarchical and very frontal. And then the second part of it was intentionally a way much more open and much more lateral. And it was about me getting feedback. And it was immensely helpful. It meant that I actually completely rewrote the talk in the next 3 days before I gave it to this much larger audience. But I like to think of everything I do as a rehearsal or a prototype. It's not just a way of, you know, it's not just a way, an excuse, but I think it's also a really productive way of thinking about prototyping ideas, testing them out, experimenting with them with other people in different situations, because I think that it makes them much more interesting, much stronger, much more resilient, and also ultimately more collaborative because other people's ideas are embedded within them.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because when I look into your or in the documents you shared with me with your portfolio and with all the informations around you, you think worth looking at, they have been very much, I don't know if the word is right, preliminary. So they have been not really finished. They're in flux. They always move. So like there's this ever-going PDF. There's this, your presentation is a Google Doc. So why do you, or is there another reason for not like finishing things up in a way. So like, because sometimes it's good to just like move on. So to keep things in a certain finished state.
Well, I mean, I think there are two ways I can answer that. I mean, one way is, of course, I do also make lots of, quote, finished things. There are books, there are exhibitions, there are texts, there are, there are all kinds of things that I've done that may exist as objects in the world. But if I'm both more philosophical and more practical about it, for one, there's a great quotation by Stanley Eveling, who's a theater director and critic, and it is, a thing is just a slow event. And I think it's really, it's a great phrase. I mean, you can find resonances of this in lots of places, from philosophy to design to religion and, you know, but that particular formulation, a thing is just a slow event, is really meaningful to me, because I think that actually, particularly as a creative person, whatever you call yourself, whether a designer, an artist, a curator, or an organizer, activist, facilitator, I think that we're always working on these longer narrative arcs, but there are these particular constraints, whether it's a market or it's the way that people perceive things, where you always see these discrete slices. And anybody who's actually living it and doing it knows that you might make a thing, but if you're really reflecting on it, it's not done when you open an exhibition or when you publish a book. It's just one version. And maybe I'm just being more explicit about that for myself. I'm calling everything more and more in the last maybe 5 years. Everything is a version. Everything is just one way station towards a kind of endless path. But, and that may sound very kind of highfalutin, but also really practically, I just mean that, like, for myself, and I think about this a lot in terms of teaching, when I was in school and I was studying photography and design, I think I had kind of false aspiration to make perfect things. And I think that was even the first 10, 15 years of my professional career. I was so obsessed with making things that were perfect, making perfect typography, having a really watertight concept, you know, making sure that everything in an exhibition was just 10 centimeters. It was just in the right place. And, you know, I think it's still important to make things well. I'm an extreme believer in the value of craft, and I'm a strong believer in making things well and in making things with love. And so it's not that I don't believe in, you know, crafting things, but I also think that perfection is really a myth and it can really slow you down.
Yeah, that's a true thing. And on the other hand, because I feel the same in a way that I'm very much more focused on process and how to do things and putting things in the foreground than showcasing or celebrating the things you did. But it's also some kind of emancipation of myself from that strange feeling of being observed and being criticized on a thing that is there, that has so much influences from other or let's say aspects that I'm not, can't be responsible for. So there's so much stuff intervening in that result that A, I can't be I don't know the English word, but I can't be criticized upon, or I can't be fully responsible for the thing there, because there's so many influences. But, and I also can't take all the lorbeeren, the laurel wealth, I don't know the English expression, like all the credits for it, because it's always a team thing and it always loses in the product. The whole nice process, everything was so super nice. And then you have it there and then you think, it was so nice, but it can't reflect the whole niceness in a way. And you write that in the responsive curation text that it's all about showing a creative process, making it visible and perceivable than showing artifacts of the process. And I want to ask you a bit more in detail, because it's some kind of a myth that from finding it here about your the P exclamation space in New York. Can you just tell me? I just know the view on that space from the perspective of your floor from that one text. And can you just give it just a short sum up on what is it all about, the P exclamation space? Well, or P, was about?
Yeah, P exclamation. It was a, you know, an experimental gallery. I called it a mom and pop Kunsthalle that was on Broome Street in New York in Chinatown. And it was there from 2012 to 2017. So exactly 5 years. And, you know, I thought of it as trying to, you know, it had a program that was trying to bring lots of different things into it: design, art, music, writing. It had an experimental curatorial approach. It worked with artists and designers and writers in lots of different modes. And it really just tried to prototype a different way of making exhibitions within New York, which came out of me having run a graphic design studio at that point in New York for, you know, almost a decade. And I do think that P was very much, there's so many backstories to P. I mean, it was 5 years of making exhibitions, and I think we probably made over 40 exhibitions and presentations in that time. So it was a lot of activity. But I realized in 2018, when I moved to Berlin with a fellowship from Kunstwerke, from KW, Institute for Contemporary Art, I realized that P had been so focused on making these perfect presentations, almost as products. You know, I really tried to make these perfect exhibitions that we would photograph in a particular way, and they were meant to each be very different. They were meant to juxtapose extremely different modes of curating and exhibition making. And they were meant to give opportunities to artists and designers in different ways. But I realized that it had been so focused on the presentation part of it that sometimes I forgot or left out of the story the process. And so what you're saying about why you value, you know, the process, because actually you both can't take too much credit and you can't take too much blame, is actually an interesting in-between point, because it allows you to learn. Like, instead of just saying, oh, I did this thing really well, look at me, it's great, that you don't learn a lot from. On the other hand, you also don't learn that much if you're constantly worried about all the mistakes you made. But if you think about it as, well, this is a learning process. You know, there's another great quote. I think I've always heard it attributed to Nelson Mandela. I never lose. I either win or I learn. And so it's like, you know, this principle that I think also, if you have children, you know, I mean, you can't raise a child perfectly. You always make mistakes, but every time you make a mistake, you pivot and you learn and you try to think of how you do it differently the next time. That, I think, is what makes it sustainable.
Yeah, there's the research conducted a few years ago, and they say that, like, regarding the learning curve, if you got 75% right, then that's the best case of learning. So you have 25% headroom to still go, and then, but you have enough right to have, like, the resource to move on. Interestingly, in the German school system, 75% is a 3. So it's like is like an American, I think it's C or something. I don't know. Like,
which is not a good grade. It's not exactly a desirable grade.
Yes, and that's for me is a very, that's a big shift in understanding, because I remember my parents being not so angry. Sorry, mom, but very, very irritated. Oh shit, it's just a 3. And like, my daughter comes home and I'm saying, it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry. It's okay. You can do better, but you can also be much more worse, but it's not a problem. Just move on. Look how much you know already. So it's just it's also a shift of the narration of how to explain grades that you did not invent it. So it's an external measuring system.
Well, I remember that. I'm so glad you say that. I mean, I had, you know, my parents, and if they ever listen to this, they'll understand what I'm saying now, hopefully not as an absolute critique, but an understanding of where they came from. I mean, they were immigrants to the US from India, and they came really because of education. And so that was the most mm-hmm. important thing for them. And so for them, they had an absolute emphasis on achievement, on getting the best grades possible, on making sure that you were at the top of your class, because for that them, that represented the opportunity to kind of advance in society and to make a life in this context. But actually, you know, there are all of these studies that show, and what you're pointing to is totally right, that if you, for example, if you say to young children, oh, you did great on that test, you got a perfect score, you're very smart, it is more likely that in the future, they'll actually start to cheat on those tests. Mm-hmm. They'll start to try to cut corners because they now have set the bar at 100% and they feel they have to maintain that. Whereas you're right, if you got a 3 or a 75% and you said to somebody, hey, look, you've got 3/4 of it and look how much more you can still learn. There's so much more space for you to move into. How much encouragement would that give? And so, I mean, yeah, I think a lot about that. I mean, I was raised in a way that was absolutely focused on achievement and perfection. And so probably what you're rightfully pointing out about my focus on process and letting things be uncertain, maybe even making mistakes in front of other people, is maybe a corrective, something I've learned now in the last 5 years or so as a way to react to, you know, the last 40 years of my life.
Yeah, and it's something that relates also to design education and how to talk to the students, because there went a little paper around on the web on how to give a critique, which I didn't know that word from the American discourse. I just called it feedback, or just in talking to students. And like this point of just focusing, hey, look how much you did and look what kind of perspectives come from your process, is so much more encouraging than maybe like just a few decades ago, how teachers or professors and advisors talk to their students, because the whole idea of perfectness and achievement was still in the generation 20 years ago very much present in a way. And I really like that you come up with that bumpiness idea, so that somehow deals with that imperfection. So it's not that slick surface that we are achieving. We do not want to have that renderings and all the world is seemingly possible, seemingly perfect. It's more about creating that friction to start the discourse about what's there, and not just like having the product that is, thank you, you've been served, idea. That is really interesting. But it would be great to hear your recap of what, or just sum up what is bumpiness, because I read the text, but the listeners did not.
Sure. I'll say something about bumpiness, and mm-hmm. I also do want to make a comment about teaching mm-hmm. there. But, well, bumpiness is a term I first started to use maybe probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And it actually really came from, I was giving a tour through an exhibition at P! Exclamation in New York to the designer David Reinfurt of Dexter Sinister and ORG, and his students from Princeton University. And I was talking about the show at P and how Exclamation and how the space functioned. And I said, well, you know, yeah, it's quite bumpy. And he said, that's a great word. You should really think about it more. And I thought, oh, okay. Well, okay, I will. And as I realized, as I started to think about bumpiness, you know, I've formulated it in a lot of ways. One is as a kind of productive friction, that so many things in our contemporary world, so many experiences are manufactured to seem perfectly smooth, to be all about a one-way consumption, simply a thing that's in front of you that's sexy and slick that you can click with a, you know, one click button, or, you know, from, or the TED talk as a format, you know, that you have a perfect 15 minute talk where there are no mistakes, no flaws, and it can go viral. Going viral has a whole nother meaning in 2020. But also design products, exhibitions, artworks, all of these things where the only response you're allowed to have to them is, oh, wow, I want that. And I'm much more interested in a mode of aesthetic, artistic production that is about opening up questions, where an object or a process or a performance or a artwork or a piece of design, whatever it is, that it actually opens up a space of discomfort or uncertainty where suddenly you look at the thing and the way it's made differently. And it's this kind of, you know, I think of bumpiness as a kind of friction, but it's also a space of exchange. Because if you think about a rough object or an object that has texture, when you rub your fingers on it, I always like to think on a smooth object, you leave no traces. But on a rough object, if you have a rock and you rub your hand on it, some pieces of that rock make their way onto your hand, but also your hand rubs off onto the object. And so there's a mutuality there. But for me, bumpiness is really about, at its core, a kind of self-reflexivity, though not necessarily intellectualized, but a way in which an object or a process can make you think about how it was made. It makes you question it and makes you try to kind of understand what's behind it. And so we can call it imperfection, we can call it friction, we can even call it close to something like Verfremdung, you know, if we were to think about Brecht and other aesthetic theories. But I've chosen bumpiness because it also, it has a kind of lumpiness in a way it sits in your hand. And for me, it's a term that's open enough that I can keep redefining it. But one word I want to just say about teaching, I think what you just said is totally right. When I went to school, when I was graduating from school over 20 years ago, the mode of critique that I was used to was so fierce. It was so vicious. It was about ripping people apart. And it was about professors really like proving how much they knew, whether it was about theory or art or anything else. And it was almost this kind of macho stance where, in retrospect, I think, you know, oh, it was like, it was probably generations of trauma that people had learned, you know, these teachers had been ripped apart by their teachers before them, and then they ripped apart their students, and then they wanted to continue that on. And what I realize is that it's all about insecurity. It's all about fear. It's about not wanting to have your hierarchy displaced. And maybe the thing at its core that I'm interested in bumpiness, but also in my practice and in my teaching, is making a space for uncertainty and making a space for vulnerability and making a space for asking those kinds of questions while also doing so with some degree of self-confidence. So it sounds like a contradiction, but I think that's what I'm looking for.
And I think that they're like two interesting things. First, the idea of creating space. That's what you already said in your initial statement, that you're a human being concerned about space. But I want to just keep a bit on the bumpiness and your or picture of the hands and the smooth surface. And thinking about smooth surfaces, I have to think about mirrors as reflective surfaces, as like planes and objects. Like they are objects, but they are mostly planes, and we look into them and we got a reflexive image of ourselves, but that's a very visual impression from a very slick surface. But keeping the image of the rock as a very non-reflective object, So like neglecting the visual impression, but offering such a broader impression from the all the senses we have. We have a haptic, tactile impression, and we can, other than the mirror, we can just like throw it on the floor and see it crack, and it's not broken in its function anymore. So it's we can just use it and learn much more about ourselves as our embodied self than from the slick mirror. And I think that the whole, like, I come from an industrial design background, but also from all the other design disciplines, I see it a moving trend from these super slick surfaces into the roughness. Yeah, let's use algae, algae, like the water seaweed, yeah. and all these raw materials to give people back some feelings that they cannot have from the use of these all aware super glossy surfaces they have in their pockets. And that is something that is super interesting also when it comes to create space, because that is something that can't be designed as an app function right now in a mobile device. That is only by having people around and materials, and that's where I want to just like make that turn towards space. And so when you say opening the space up, how do you do that? How do you open spaces for others and for yourself? When looking back to the P space and to what I know must exist, the K space.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I'm obviously still learning. We're all learning this. I mean, I think this is a path of at least the last, I can think back at least 12 years, but probably also longer. I remember the first workshop I ever taught in Germany, in Bremen, at the the Universität der Kunst, or whatever it was called back then. And it was a workshop with a group of design students thinking about how to make a collective space, a space that would serve different communal functions. And in many ways, that week was a real experiment for what do you need to put in, what are the protocols, what are the skills you need to actually do that. And I think I never learned them, because in art school, again, most of our art school teaching, and this is one of the ironies for me, is that even though I studied graphic design, which is inherently a collaborative discipline, when I learned graphic design, everybody did their projects on their own. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of the teaching I had in art, and now when I think about it, in all of the other subjects, I mean, all of the classes I took, we wrote our papers individually. We handed in on our assignments as a single person. We did everything alone. We actually never learned how to ask questions, how to listen to each other, how to work with each other and collaborate. And so I think it was first when I started teaching also at the Rhode Island School of Design, where I tried to create a number of projects and seminars that tested out collaboration with the students. Nowadays, I think about that a lot in terms of soft skills, like the kind of relational skills that we have. I mean, of course, certain, as you mentioned before, certain surfaces are permeable and porous, and certain surfaces are actually totally closed off and sealed off, and they don't allow you to enter into them. So that's to say, I think there are design decisions and also architectural frameworks that make it harder for other people to make any impression or to change something. But I think about this a lot on the level of behaviors, on how can we teach design students, but also curatorial students, artists, and others, the ways of asking questions, the ways of listening to somebody in an active way, where you're not just trying to overlay your perspective, but you're really trying to understand where they come from. But also, even within a critique situation or giving feedback, what are the ways of giving feedback where you're trying to, again, you're trying to overlay your voice and tell somebody what to do versus what are the ways of asking people the questions that allow them to figure out for themselves what they want to do. So these are a lot of methods that I think about in design, but I also think that they're meaningful. I think about them a lot in teaching, but I think they're really meaningful in design because more and more, I've said this for a very long time, but as designers, I believe we have to start from asking questions. We always have to start a project from really trying to understand it in some ways, while also acknowledging the limits of our own understanding, acknowledging that we can't understand somebody else's subjective position entirely. But what we can try to do is we can try to like find some space in between it. And I think I did this intuitively for a very long time. And it's probably only in the last, again, maybe 5 years or so, that it's explicitly part of the process that I believe in, where, you know, I will never start any project, whether it's a design project, an art project, curatorial project, without first sitting down and trying to ask all of the people whom I know to be involved with it, and maybe even other people, what they think, what's at stake, why they're doing it, what the goals are, and trying to first understand and hear those things before I start with my own impressions. But that's not to say, I just want to, on the other hand, the flip side is, I think that the individual and the collective are both really useful modes. And I think that even if they're kind of a myth in the sense that I think that nobody does anything alone, everybody does everything. I mean, even on the level of our cells, our bodies are composed of, you know, almost more bacteria and other creatures, which are not technically us, than they are ourselves. And we know this from evolutionary biology. We know this from anthropology. We know this from all of these different, from neuroscience, from different models of cognition. At the same time, I think that the myth of individuality as it's developed in the so-called Western world over the last 500 years or so has been very useful. I do think there's something useful that comes out of having an individual position, but it's useful because it's in a spectrum. Now, that might sound too abstract. I'm getting a little bit too big picture here, but I'm just trying to balance the two in my head.
I just made myself some notes while you were talking. And of course, I think it's honestly, like in between us, it's totally clear that we start from asking people about demands, about needs, about their impressions, like getting all the voices heard on the table and even getting more in, even cross about like species borders around. But like observing some sort of historical ways why we have that feeling that this has to be is because that a lot of spaces, let it be schools, let it be art spaces and galleries, have been all about like having a hierarchic structure in their self. And they always have been, not always, but like from my perspective, it's about making statements. And statements is something that is that's very opponent to discussion, because like people are so leaving, look at all the talk shows. No, it should not be called talk shows. It should be like statement shows, because it's one statement after the other. And it's not about talking about things, talking about consents, talking about a shared view. So, and I think this is something that comes from a strong individual focus that says, I have to be clear. I have to just drop my perspective, have to make my statement to be received or perceived in a like a linear row of individual people that we are. So and we change it, like as you say, and that's how I'm going to, not having a linear like a thread of pearls of individuals, but have like a bowl of pearls interacting with each other, bumping in and let's see where they go. They create sound, they have friction, and they rearrange more or less naturally than we have that kind of strict structure in the end. But the question is, how do you do that in, for example, in an exhibition or in planning an event in one of your spaces? What is that process on an example level?
One that I'm learning now is to actually leave space. I mean, I think that one of the things that often happens, and this relates to our earlier strand about perfection, sometimes when you completely like design a thing 150%, actually what happens is it means that there's no space for other people mm-hmm. to have yeah, an idea in it. And you know, one of the things that I always appreciate in graphic design, again, I'll mention Carl Martens, I appreciate how in a lot of his most important work, and going back decades, there's a kind of unfinished quality. There's something where there's some strong idea, but then there's also just space where things are not too precious. And that allows maybe for you both as a user and as a person to enter into it. I mean, even a really literal example is nowadays, as a principal, I take notes in every book I buy. No matter how nice or expensive or I write notes, I underline things, I have to for myself. And you notice there are books that kind of allow you to do that well, and there are books that don't. There are books that simply don't have that action in mind. And I mean, I can think of a lot of like coffee table books, mm-hmm. the books that are made as catalogs that exist only to be seen, but not even to be read. In a physical space, I think it starts from actually creating opportunities that are invitations, that are questions. Like instead of, I mean, the standard wall text in a museum used to be something that tried to pack into 150 words, like 100 to 150 words, exactly what you were meant to think about an object, you know, for example. And I remember years ago when making an exhibition at the Art Institute of Chicago with my colleagues, Adam Michaels and Rob Giampietro at Project Projects, I remember we decided to write all of the wall labels as questions, where we had a set of statements, and then we also asked these kind of questions of the viewer about what they thought about the work they were seeing. And it was a way, it was maybe a little bit of a game, but it gave us a different way to write those and to try and engage with people. And in events, it's something I'm thinking a lot about these days, because during this year of 2020, I've really been trying to think about how can communal collective spaces emerge online? And what are the different ways that we can create more decentralized, more lateral exchanges between people? A sense of, I mean, one of the things I'm really scared about is that I think that in the kind of, in the you know, Zuma scene, like after the kind of coronavirus, with the rise of all of these kind of mass communications technologies, it allows for people to be closer to people they already know. For example, it's easy for me to talk to my family, to my close friends, and to really be even more, you know, intimate with them than I used to be, because I talk to them many times a week. But it's harder to meet people whom you don't already know. Mm-hmm. And so actually, you it's harder to make space and to create opportunities for people who are outside of your bubble. And that happens on social media already for a very long time. But I'm starting to think about sometimes when you have a public event, the idea is to really choreograph the whole thing. And I'm guilty of this sometimes too, to say, I have to make sure that, you know, we have everything planned down to the 5 minutes. But what happens if you actually open up a space where things go wrong? As just one example, I remember I was doing a kind of program called Microsolidarity Practice Program, run by an organization called The Hum. And it was really a kind of facilitation training that was supposed to happen over 2 weeks in these four sessions. And it was amazing. It actually taught me a lot of soft skills and tools, ways of bringing people together, asking questions, protocols for how people can communicate that I think, again, I had to learn on my own. Nobody ever taught me these things in school, but I wish that somebody had actually taught me these at some point. But the thing that was remarkable is there was one of the sessions where the technology failed, where they had intended on Zoom to have breakout rooms of a certain kind, and Zoom, there was a bug and it didn't work. And so we went into these breakout rooms, and then after 2 minutes, they pulled us all back out and they said, hey, this is not working. We're just not going to be able to do the session today. And so if you need to leave, you can leave, or you can stay. And actually a bunch of people ended up just staying for 45 minutes. And it was totally unprogrammed, unplanned. And it was very vulnerable because we saw also how they as organizers dealt with the failure of the plan that they had set out. And it was one of the most meaningful sessions. So I'm not saying that you want to intentionally build failure into everything, but I think that sometimes just leaving that space and not trying to determine everything, it might be less comfortable, because I, at least for myself, I know that I like to know that everything is, there's an answer to everything, but it might let other people have space to put in what they think.
Yeah, I agree, because that's what I'm, what I also have, like, when in the Zoom meeting, like a larger call or whatever it is, just not be the first to opt out on the red button, but to see who stays in. And sometimes it's just some people not really finding the button, and then there's just four of them, and then I have a question that I'm not really, or anybody else was doing this, that I have a question I wasn't really encouraged enough to ask in the big round. So then there is these like little things happening with some certain sort of magic in the end. And but it's good that you bring up the corona topic, because it's on my list here as well. And thinking about the corona thing and having these like Zoom meetings, like larger meetings, I'm just like exploding, because it's like sometimes two a day with people from totally different environments and like parts of myself, and that's very exhausting in a way. And but what I miss, and that's what all of them lack, is to bump in somebody, to just like be there, and then hey, we haven't seen since years. And or you stand there with somebody that you do not know, but it looks like he's some sort of a sympathetic guy, and then you just start chatting, and well, yeah, nice, cool, and then you make something up. And that's what I'm bought on all these conferences and meetups and stuff. I'm rarely interested in what people say on stage, but more on, let's hang out with somebody. There's some guy I didn't saw a few years ago, so some things like that. And that's very interesting, and that is not yet transferred into cyberspace. So, and that's what I see. I really, really miss is just meet somebody I haven't seen since a few weeks, just on the street, because everybody is so locked away from physical gatherings to stay for themselves. And I really crave for this, to just meet somebody accidentally. So this is something that there was this chat roulette thing back in the days that seems to work, but it's not something that I want to do in my own home, sitting here and waiting for somebody to pop up on my screen. I want to have physical existence in and bars and drinks and stuff. So that's what's missing, as well as some sort of lubricant, social lubricant for that. And but as you're talking, do you see a chance or a glimpse of to get this over to the cyberspace?
Well, I mean, I hear you for sure, that I think we're so used to, there's something very intuitive about being in one's body, meeting people, and you might have a very large scale grouping, but then it can quickly just become a conversation with one other person. I mean, I remember very clearly also how Hurrah Hurrah a year ago did that so well. And I agree, it's harder online. But I think that that's also, it's one of the things I'm really thinking a lot about these days, is how can you create more opportunities for a meaningful, smaller scale exchange? Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to design that into the system. I mean, sometimes because we don't, I mean, there are ways already that I see things moving, like even on a technology level, Zoom has started now to have open breakout rooms where people can choose which breakout room they want to go into, and can, you know, when we were last week together with my partner, Emily Smith, we were helping to design a conference for the University of Bergen and the Stavanger Kunst, the Kunstmuseum Stavanger, and in Norway. And so we created like a breakout room that was almost like a cafe that people could go into at breaks or in lunchtime and meet other people at a different scale. It actually seemed to work very well. I think that there are going to always be technological possibilities that will open up and change. I think sometimes that's also design. Like, I think that I oftentimes nowadays, both with students, but also in public events, try to change the scales. I try to say, we're not going to all be there as 50 people for the whole time, but maybe you actually do put people into another grouping, whether it's 3 people, 4 people, 8 people, 2 people, for a shorter period of time, which can sometimes be uncomfortable because you're suddenly confronted by another person you don't already know. But my experience so far is that if you give people a little bit of a prompt, a little bit of either a question that they might each ask themselves or a way of relating, for example, why don't you know, we're going to put you in groups with 2 people and we're going to ask you to just ask each other a set of questions and then you'll get to know each other for 10 minutes and then you'll come back to the main group. Almost without an exception now, I'm realizing there's probably some, what do you call it? There's like some data error in the sense that maybe I'm mostly getting the responses from the people who like it. But I mean, like a project that I've been working on with an artist named Kalia Mallory is called, that seems very important to me in this, is a project called The Human Way. I mean, it's like the artist's way, but the artist is crossed out and replaced with human. And it relates to this book, a popular self-help book called The Artist's Way that's been, you know, about 30 years old and has been a massive bestseller in America. But long story short, what the artist Kalia Mallory and I have done is invited anybody who wants to take part in this project, which is like a 12-week self-guided course where every day you write for yourself and you kind of follow a path to thinking through your own creative blocks and your practice. But then we've also put them randomly into small groups, into groups of 8 people or so, where they are supposed to meet every week or two, almost like a reading group, but they're suddenly confronted by people they don't know and they have to discuss with them and get to know each other. And for the most part, what we've heard back from the feedback has been incredible. People are saying, I'm actually meeting new people that I never would have met. And it feels like some kind of answer to the isolation of Corona. And so I don't know, there's not one answer, but it's just that I think that is the question. Like, I think we are going to be in a world where so many more of our interactions will be mediated by means of digital technology rather than doing as many things in person. And I think that the in-person activities and meetings will become more and more elite. Actually, I think that there's going to be a real value placed on those, and there's going to be a lot of other restrictions and constraints, but also privileges associated with them. And so I think that what that means is that if I want to think about creating and enabling more decentralized lateral mutual connections, it means that I, as a designer and a thinker, need to really invest in what are the ways, both through technology, but also through like kind of activities and soft skills and other tools, how can I create those situations of connection in an online space as well? How can I create, like, how can I help to make space for people to have that connection?
The interesting question here is, how much do you have to do a workaround on certain technological issues, like using Zoom with its, like given tools and given options, and how much do you need to learn to code, for example, to make your own digital space without we think in the frames of Google Meet, of Skype, of Zoom, of like that stuff, but maybe there is to gain what you go for a change of that system, of that whatever. I can't imagine yet. I just need some time for that. But still, you need like deep knowledge of how to do it. Do you have that?
Well, I think it's both and. I think that mm-hmm. we both, I mean, I think you're totally right. And that is the thing I'm working on thinking about now is how to actually create new digital architectures, mm-hmm. new yeah. platforms that can create that kind of interaction and the space that I'm looking for. But I think it's both and, because I think we have to work both on the level of platform. I mean, I always think in terms of platforms, affordances, and behaviors, and all mm-hmm. three of them relate to each other. And so it's in a way, you know, on the one hand, I do want to reimagine platforms and think about what could be possible. But even within the platforms, like Zoom was not created to have group karaoke, but it actually can work for group karaoke with some flaws, but it can do that. And, you know, so you can change. I think we have to be working on all parts of that triangle, the platforms, the affordances, and the behaviors at once, because there's not a singular solution. There's not one way to deal with it. It's actually like, you know, we're going to keep using, what's the Bruno Latour line? You know, that I use a hammer at the same time as I use a drill. One is, you know, thousands of years old. One is, I'm paraphrasing, one is maybe 100 years old. But will you call me a postmodern human because I use these different tools? No, we're going to keep calling people on the phone, and we're going to be on these kind of ever more, you know, embodied digital platforms, and we're also going to be in real life with other people at times. All of these modes of interaction, even today, somebody asked me to send them a fax. Can you believe that? So, like,
it was a German Amt, isn't it?
These means of, it was a bank. So, of course. So, I was like, you know, so each of these modes of communication will continue to exist. All of these interfaces and the skills we learn in one, we will take into the next one. So the etiquette and the protocols that we learn from working online and how to create a connection with somebody in Zoom will come back into how we act in physical space. And that's actually, for me, what's exciting is that it's one more set of possibilities for how we as humans can communicate. And I think that communication is really, I mean, that's what I think design is. That's what I think art is. It's about communication and finding ways to commune with other people, to create community.
What I think can be a bit trickier on that is that that this is some sort of working with code and as the tool to design, and prototyping with code is some sort of it's working or it's not working, and so it's difficult to work in the process as I know it, to okay, let's do it like this, let's do it like that, it's not good enough, but it's already working, and having this high tech thing with a lot of people calling in from different things, having all these data rates managed and stuff, it's something that needs a different skill from the designer, and I think it's something that we have to take care to enable ours, like talking for myself and for my colleagues from the design universities, to enable everybody to learn that language. I heard a podcast with an AI researcher. He said that it's more important to learn Python than French. And I think that can be something that is very interesting as also for the cognitive way of how to communicate in a digital way. So now we use like language, like I use words, you use words, we share that one language mutually, but it's not that we talk in the same language as the machine talks to each other, and this is something that also can change, like that it needs us to change as well as we need to have the interface going to change, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that each language, each way of communicating, it inevitably transforms how we perceive ourselves, how we relate to others. And again, I don't think it's an either or. I think it's a both mm-hmm. and. I mean, working with students, for example, in Hamburg in the Klasse Digitale Grafik this last semester, with them, you know, for them, they are digital natives who can also really work fluidly with code, and where that is a prototyping tool. I mean, my mother was a roboticist and programmer. I probably should have learned those things better than I did, but I unfortunately didn't. But the point is that it gives me a lot. I actually think it gives me a lot of hope. I mean, there's a weird thing where I think it's easy to look at the world right now and the situation of where we've been for the last year and be depressed about all of these things, from the political situation, the environmental situation, these kind of social issues, issues of structural racism and inequality, how they come up. And I mean, there are moments when I wake up and I'm very sad, but actually for the most part, I'm kind of, I still have this belief in a kind of action, like a way that we can learn and transform. And that actually, if we're open to that transformation, if we're open to actually letting go of the things that we take for granted, there's actually more opportunities that are in front of us in the years to come.
Prim, that sounds like a good ending word, isn't it? So you seem to sum it up in a way, and that's a tricky thing for me, just to how to find an end in that super interesting story, because I just wanted to talk about hierarchy in visual systems in Google Meets and having like all that stuff, but I think we have to move this to the next step or to the next episode.
Yeah, we can do another podcast. I mean, I would love to talk about hierarchy. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation. I mean, in terms of how visual display, but. No, yeah.
Then we take Matthias Görlich to it as well, because
exactly.
He wrote that book, or he co-published that book about architecture education from the 60s in mostly in Germany, and there are so embarrassing, disgustingly examples of hierarchy from professors towards students that and he knows best, and from him I learned a lot with the students on changing that hierarchy systems in design and art education. Prim, still the last words belong to you. I thank you for your time and shared insights, and After your last words, I just like hit the record button again, and then we are off.
Good. Well, wait. Do you need the last word from me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I mean, thank you. I mean, I think that this has been a great conversation, and I do feel like there's so much more to continue. But thinking about the relationship of design and learning, I think we're in a learning moment. Like, we are in a human-wide, species-wide learning moment, which I think is also what makes it exciting.
Der Design-Podcast der Burg.